Hi, my name is Alan. I'm a business designer and welcome to the Beyond Users podcast, where we learn about business to become better designers. In the 26th episode, I spoke with Matiz Pilzel, a product design director at Ziltra, which is basically a creative management platform for digital advertising. I wanted to invite Matiz to this podcast because he has gone through the whole experience where he basically started in the same company as a junior designer to today having the proverbial seat at the table. So I wanted to see how this journey looked like and what does even having a seat at the table mean. So a few specific topics we touched upon and I think you might find interesting are the scalable design. So what it basically is and why is it important for feasibility and viability of the company. We talked about having a seat at the table. What does it mean and how do you get one? And also, how does a design process look like at Ziltra? Just one more thing before diving into the episode. If you want to learn more about business, you can visit my website, beyondusers.com. And there you can take a 5-day email course, which I put together. It's called Mini MBA for Designers. And in these emails, I present 5 business concepts that are relevant for designers and that I've also used in my design process. So that's available on beyondusers.com. And now, without further ado, here is a conversation with Matiz. Cool. Matiz, first of all, thanks a lot for taking the time. It's a pleasure to have you here. So first of all, let's kick off with how did you even get into design? You know, how did you get familiar with this world and what was your first role and how did you get into the community?
How did I get started with design? I kind of was thinking about this over the week, and I don't know. I kind of was always interested in computers. My first kind of run in with computers was, I think I was 8 years old or something like that, in a school, you know, in Slovenia.
Yeah,
and I kind of fell in love, and obviously it started with games, but then, you know, as I went or grew older, I kind of wanted to do something, you know, and I went to a programming high school, but I didn't really like it, so I needed to do something else, so I started to, I don't know, learn Photoshop, you know, and 3D programs, but I didn't like modeling, but I liked doing the renders, right? I liked playing with the outcomes. So I kind of eased myself into it, I guess.
So you went from a developer to designer, basically.
I would never call myself a developer, really. I know what... how it works. I know how a computer works, but I've never really written any, you know, proper code. You know, the most code I've written that I can tell you about is when we were taught about C# libraries. I got really cross with, you know, with all the libraries I had to include because I always forgot one. And I thought I was very smart by just opening them up, you know, in a text editor, copying everything out of them and pasting it into a library that I called all.h. And when I included that, the very small program that I wrote broke. So I've learned why they are separated, you know.
Still, I mean, that's more code than most people write in their lives. So,
I guess. Yeah.
You know what's interesting though is that I had a similar conversation also in the 23rd episode with Tulio. He also started more as a developer and then went into design. And I almost feel like there is some pattern here. Like, and I'm just asking myself, do you feel like it is a big advantage if you have some developer background or just understanding of how the code is written as a designer?
I would say yes, because it teaches you more of a different approach to problem solving. So if you are a developer, or you don't even have to be a developer, it's just this systematic approach to problem solving that, you know, a more technical person uses usually.
Okay, what about the handover between a designer and the more tech person?
Oh yeah, okay. So in that case, I kind of feel that this is your duty as a, you know, if you're a product designer, if you worked as a web designer in the, you know, past, I think that your one of your requirements as a designer is to know code and how it's not necessarily write code, but to know code, know the limitations, obviously, right? So you don't produce designs that are not, you know, really hard to produce on the engineering end.
I think we're slowly also starting to get into the kind of the big topic that I wanted to discuss with you, which is designing for scalability, right?
Yes.
Can we maybe define what scalable design and designing for scalability even means?
So this is actually a nice,
segue.
Rollover segue. Yeah, thank you. So, yes, if you know, you know, what you're building or how it's built, you will kind of go around the hurdles, or you will help your fellow teammate to, you know, be more efficient. So with that, I can tell you what non-scalable design usually looks like, because I think if you kind of start, oh, you know, scalable design looks like this and that, and then people are like, but we're doing that, right? But if we start with what it's not, I think it's a better kind of wake-up call usually.
Yeah, perfect.
So usually it starts with the actual design files. So be it Sketch, be it Figma, whatever you use, even Photoshop, right? I've seen this all over the place. So there's no naming system. So people use, you know the old joke, final one, final two, final 55, final, really final version one, and so on, right? It's a running joke. And it's basically, it's a lack of discipline, right? And then it spills into the file itself. So you have a file, and then within the file, it's just, you know, it's a free-for-all, right? There's layers everywhere. There's nothing is named. Everything is like just like thrown in, and, you know, that's it, right? In the engineering world, this is called spaghetti code, right? The person that comes after you can't use it. So this is where it starts. But then what that causes is things start to be copied by eye, right? You kind of look at the existing design, and then you're like, uh-huh, okay, I need this. And then people start just copying it by eye, right? Oh, I need this dropdown. And they just draw it and then apply the dirty file and the no naming system to it. And you have a, you know, you just perpetuate the problem. Mm-hmm. What that results in is that you will then forget a state of the dropdown. For instance, I'm just using a dropdown as an example, right? You will forget an error state for the dropdown. You'll make a small mistake when you pick the color, stuff like that, right? If we remember the clear type anti-aliasing, right? This was like a actual problem that we had, was our engineers were color picking the text color on the screen, right, or off the screenshot. And what ClearType does is it makes a left and right ghost of the text, and then colors one blue and one orange. And then if you pick, right, you will pick the wrong color if you're not directly on the pixel. So we had like 10 different hex codes for the same color in CSS, right? So obviously this is not scalable, right? And I'm not even talking about the collaboration between the teams, which makes it really hard, right? If you have files and a system like that, and you know, it's just all over the place, and you end up with five different designs in the same product or design you know, styles.
So if I understand correctly, one of the problems of not following the scalable design is that also the speed can then be slower, right? Because you're not reusing the same assets, you're just reinventing the same wheel, then you're slower. But then the second problem is also then that you're not coherent. Basically, you're using different elements for what should be the same element or the same asset.
Yes, yes. The usual suffers, right? You have less efficiency, obviously, because you have to rebuild stuff. Consistency isn't there at all, right? Maybe you try to do it, but it's really hard because you're basically restarting every project. And, you know, when it comes to development, it's also slow because you don't have existing objects to reuse, right? You can't. Basically, there's no reuse of elements because they don't exist, right? And then people start building their own kind of, and then one developer has his own, the other has his own, or teams, you know, like, it's not a nice sight.
So how do you approach creating a scalable design?
So usually what it takes is a design system. But design system come in different shapes and sizes, right? So what I would like to kind of do is like a very high level dive into it, not very into the weeds, but just a high level dive. So we can kind of see what it solves, right? Or mm-hmm. Why do you need it, right? What does it solve? So in short, the design system helps with transparency, collaboration, and efficiency, right? Transparency means that anyone can contribute to the system. Right. So a junior designer figures out that, let's say, you need a combo drop-down, whatever, you know, the little checkbox thing. And it's not present in your design system. So the non-transparent situation would be, no, we don't use that, right? We figure out something else, right? But the transparent use, or the more open use, would be, so what are we trying to solve there? And try to incorporate it, if it has any meaning, obviously, right? Try to incorporate it with the whole team. So everyone's briefed at the same time and they know, so this is another piece to the system. Collaboration, right? You know, when we talked about how developers kind of, I just mentioned it before, right? So it just means that you support each other. Be it designers, be it, you know, product managers, be it engineers, but you build a system that can support anyone with their work, right? So one team would use it for making quick prototypes, right? The other team would use it to build an actual product, like in development, right? And so on and so forth. But the result of all of these things is that you are more efficient. You're basically building a tool for yourself, for your design organization to be more efficient.
So, I mean, the big question for me is, like, when does it make sense to start creating the design system, to start thinking about the scalable design?
That's a good question. Yeah. So obviously there's no, you know, cutoff line. That's, you know, you should be three designers and that kind of a product and you need a design system, right? But I would say that, you know, in the discipline is needed from the start, obviously, right? But discipline isn't a design system. It's just clean files and, you know, a clear system to naming so people can reuse files if there's no system. Because a design system would be that the code and the design are basically the same thing. So you could start with that. You could have like a, you know, basic system in place, which is design files and like a naming system for those files, so everyone can find their way around the design files. But then when you grow and when your product becomes more and more complex, let's say you start with an app. An app usually is, you know, sometimes it needs a design system, sometimes it doesn't. It depends how complex it is. But let's say something that has two states doesn't need a design system, obviously, right? Because it's a one Photoshop file or one sketch file. But something that has multiple products will need a design system. So I would say you could do without a design system with a simple product, yes, but when it becomes more complex and starts having different pillars in it, right? When different teams start working on it. Actually, that would be a great cutoff point, actually, yeah. When you start having different teams on the same product, you will start needing a design system as a means of communication and collaboration.
I'm just wondering whether there's also a point at which you need like somebody like a designer who only takes care of the design system part. Is that even a thing?
Exactly. Uh-huh. It is. We have that person. And it's usually accompanied by a developer too. So because I mentioned that it's basically the same thing, right? The design and the code need to be the same thing, the same system. Because you can't have a design system and then it gets implemented differently every time, right? So that won't work. So what we do is we have one person that does the design and kind of makes everyone, you know, contribute, and then they work together with the engineering to create little pieces of that design. We call them symbols, I guess, or little components that are then being used when you create a prototype or when you're creating designs, right? The ultimate in this obviously is that you have a single source of truth. I think Airbnb is trying to do that. I'm not sure. But basically, imagine it that your design is saved in a form of code. So, you know, you don't have files. I mean, you don't have design files I guess you do, but it's the same thing, right? The code and the design.
But designers still work in Sketch and Photoshop and stuff.
Well, with Sketch, it's harder. But with tools like Figma, it's a bit easier.
So, okay, got it.
So that's why I think Uber is switching or switched to Figma, right? So if I just go a bit deep, just for a second, right?
Sure.
That would mean that I do the design, for instance, or not me. Let's say someone else does the design, and then it gets implemented into our repository, if you will, into our design system, and then what are they called? The little symbols that I pull from the design systems are not files, the sketch files. They are code. And then that code gets translated into design pieces. Okay?
Makes sense.
So basically when we change one thing, it behaves like code, like a sweeping change. So when you change a color, it's changed everywhere. You don't have to change 10 files.
Got it. I'm just curious, like at what point... at what size did you need at Celtra? Did you need like a designer and a coder to take care just of the design system?
I would defer back to the complexity of the product, right? So at a certain point, we realized we have a problem. So we realized that we have about three or four different designs. You know, in our product. So that wasn't ideal. But updating it, you always run into the old adage, which is, we can't do that. It's too, you know, ingrained into the monolith structure, whatever, right? So you wanted to change the color and you couldn't because there's like 20 CSS files that needed changing.
Yeah.
Right? So obviously that's not ideal, right? So We started experiments with a library, I think about 2 or 3 years ago even, right? But implementing that into the workflow and implementing that into our structure or design organization took a while, but not because of, I think it's a mixture of discipline and the tools that are available today, kind of, they became a bit more,
friendly for that?
Not friendly, but they matured.
Okay, yeah, right?
So if you think about when we started doing this, we were still, or some of us were still on working on Photoshop or with Photoshop, right? Then Sketch came along and we adopted that, and it was much better because at the time, you know, Photoshop was kind of meh with artboards, and you basically had to do states in Photoshop, which was a nightmare. So then came along Sketch. We were very happy with it, but it was still, it also had the, you know, the cornerstone of modular design, which is a symbol. So with that, we were able to scale our, I guess, our production a bit better. But now with tools like, you know, Figma and all the updates to that Sketch did, it's even easier.
Interesting. Like, I almost feel there is a correlation between the state in the industry, in the design industry, and the community, mm-hmm. and with the tools that we are having.
Oh yeah, I definitely think that this, let's call it procedural design. I think John Maeda called it something else, but basically it's like this. You're creating rules, a rule set, basically, instead of, you know, screens or throwing, you know, different layers on and kind of arranging them. It's much more closer to what code is than, you know, what design used to be. I mean, not really. My thoughts are still that real good design is still, or always was, rule making, not just, you know, oh, we need this here and this, that. That's just styling.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, what do you mean by rule making, that being a good design?
Okay, so if you let's think of this is very much I guess a product design thing, but product design is getting bigger and bigger. There's like a huge thing now. So when you design a product, you don't want, you're basically designing little modules, right? You don't want each screen to be a separate affair, right? You want, this kind of ties into the whole scalability thing, right? So yeah. I don't want each screen to use different modules. So think about it in a way of, so on this screen, I have a dropdown or a search dropdown or whatever, right? But on the other screen that also has search, it's a different affair, right? Why? You know, right? So when you're not doing it screen by screen, you should be thinking about each little module and how it will translate onto each, you know, state, basically. So if I talk about the search widget or whatever, right? I designed the search widget so it will work in both cases. So it will cover both cases. And I design it in a sense that, you know, it resizes properly. And that's my job, right? I set up all the rules. So it should resize in this manner. When it's in this state, this transition is so and so, right? Do you know what I mean? Or does it make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. So we are more designing the principle behind the solution, and then you can reuse that thing
exactly
in other places.
Yeah. You have to think a lot about how it will be used and how it will adapt itself. So basically, you're designing rules for the design.
Mm. Let's also talk about your design process, right?
Uh-huh.
How do you go from having a goal, probably a business goal, to designing solutions?
So my answer will be a bit more product management colored, but I think it's a nice mix of business and design, because it's ultimately it's intertwined.
Yeah, perfect. So
let's start. So how do we start, basically, right? Because starting is also very important. So usually you will get a set of goals that the business has or wants to achieve. And then from those goals, we start with a problem definition, usually around a persona, right? So we define the problem. What is it, right? What are we trying to solve and for who? Then, I mean, you could call this a discovery phase, if you will, right? So then we come up with two or more hypotheses, which are different solutions for the same problem. Ideally, different solutions come from different teams that are solving this one problem, business problem. Then what we do is we start, sketching it out. We start building it out to kind of see if it makes sense. And we start a quick round of validation experiments. And what to validate is, does it have business value? Yes, no. So that's usually with your sales team, you can do that, right? Then you check, does it have value for customers, right? That's usually product market fit, right? If they see value in your product, perfect, right? But how much, right? Or it's a bit of a tricky process, because sometimes people say what you want to hear, right?
Yeah.
Then you have, we kind of all do this, and we also touched on this when we were talking about designers and engineers, right? Then there's the feasibility experiment, right? You basically go to your team and you go through what you would like to build and see if it's possible, right? Does the technology cover that? Can we already do that? Can we not? Is it too expensive to build? Is it too expensive to maintain, and so on, right? And then at the end, we need a usability experiment or validation, right? Because it's connected, right? If you don't have usability, you don't have business value, right? And vice versa. If you don't have business value, you can't do usability, because no one's going to buy it.
Mm. Right? Let me try to recap this to see if I got it correctly. So there's a set of business goals or one business goal. From that goal, you try to basically create hypotheses about the problem. And then for each problem, hypothesis for a solution. And yes. Then for that solution hypothesis, you basically run some experiments. And if I understand correctly, you first run an experiment for viability with a sales team. Then you test it with customers for desirability, and then with the tech team for feasibility. And then lastly, as a last point, then you test the usability.
So the validation or the experiments aren't really, it depends on the project.
Yeah.
So I will say it depends greatly on the project, right? So if you start with a project that's dealing with AI, for instance, right, you will obviously first go test feasibility.
Yeah.
You don't sell it. And then, you don't go test it with clients, because they're going to go nuts, right? AI, right? Perfect. And then see, you can't do it. So I would go with feasibility first. And same for everything else, right? Maybe you have a great product, but it's not really sellable. So business might be a bit, might be a good thing to start with.
That's a great point, right? So you need to identify where the biggest risk is.
Exactly.
Exactly. But does it sometimes happen that you can test a few things together? Like, can you test desirability?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. So for instance, if you make a, let's call it a high fidelity prototype, which we usually use to kind of test with clients, because you could do paper and pencil, but it needs to be very, very nicely put out to the customer, because if they think this is your solution, it might be a problem, right? But anyway, mm-hmm. So you do a high fidelity prototype and you go and you kind of test the value, right? If they see value, then the question of if you can sell it is not such a big problem, right? Okay, they see value, so now how are we going to sell it is a much lesser problem than before. It might be tricky in the sense of, there is value, but we don't have the business structure to support this. So if you think about, so the recent SaaS revolution, right? So not so recent, but still. Before, you were selling software, one by one, like license-based, right? But now you're selling it as a subscription. So if the client gets kind of very excited about the licensing part, right? Because they kind of assumed it's gonna be there or stay, but you want to sell it as a subscription, that might be something you want to test along with the value, right? But if it's not, it's fair to say it's fine.
So I'm just curious, like you talked about also, in this case, almost changing like a business model for the product, right? Mm. So who is usually involved in this team who is creating these experiments and coming up with the hypothesis and then testing them? So in Celtra, like who is part of this team? Like how does a one design team or a product team look like?
So usually there's a product lead or a product manager that will lead the product. And part of that team is an engineering lead and a design lead, but that's also based on the product, right? If it's an API product, you don't need a designer, but if it is, you will need one. And then we would all sit together, and do some thinking. So this is the whole ideation or the discovery phase. Usually, it's on the product manager to come up with, to prepare everyone, right? So to do the research, to do the market stuff, to kind of come up with the materials. But then it's on the team to come up with solutions.
And how do you divide work in Celtra? Like, who does, like how, around what do you bundle teams?
Usually it's project-based. But projects can be fairly big. So it could be initiative-based, if you will. So this is a bit of a fluid situation with us. So you could be assigned to an initiative or you could be on a project. Or a product, even. My favorite would be that we are focused around a business problem, which is handed down, from the leadership. So, if we are all working towards solving a business problem, it makes the most sense, and it makes the most innovation. Like the environment is set for most innovation. So that would be my best case scenario.
Okay, got it. Tell us a little bit more also about your journey at Celtra. Like, you joined the company in the very early stage, and now you have this proverbial seat at the table, something that a lot of people in the community talk about lately. And I think it would be interesting to hear from your perspective, what does a seat at the table even mean?
It means you're scared shitless all the time.
sounds like a dream come true, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, how I started at Celtra was as a designer, but on the advertising end. So at the time, we had a creative services team, which basically supplied. It was an agency for our clients, basically. So, and we made ads, and we had all the workings of an agency. And, I don't know why, but I like to hang out with engineers a lot. So, when I found a bug or when I found something annoying, I would tell them. And this kind of became a tradition. And I think they liked it. And also our product team liked it. I didn't even know there was a product or product team at the time. I didn't know what it meant. So, you know, gradually I kind of elbowed my way into the product design team. I get annoyed with stuff that's not efficient. So, you know, at a certain point they said, well, then you fix it, right? And I was like, well, fine, then I'll fix it. So here we are, right? So I started working as a product designer. I just called myself a designer. I don't know. I still thought it's the same thing. Obviously, there's a distinction, but my dream was to work on authoring tools. You know, I always loved Adobe and Photoshop and stuff like that. You know, After Effects. And when I saw Builder, which we call our tool or one of our tools, I wanted to work on it. And when I got this opportunity, I obviously jumped on it, right? So fast forward some years, I was a product designer. I was working on the tool. I was making the tool itself. But I wanted more control. So at the time, again, I didn't know what the product manager is or whatever, right? So I just started designing different solutions for the problems that we identified. And, you know, it's basically what I described before, right? Different approaches to the same problem. But I did it in a form of prototypes. So high fidelity prototypes, if you will. And then, you know, all of a sudden, I was a product manager. For the first half year, I didn't even know I was a product manager. It was a bit of a low-key transition. But it came with a lot of, you know, you have to start writing specs. You're kind of, it's on you to move the team forward. You know, you're the little leader there, right? You need to make sure everything is taken care of. So that was scary, right? And then from there, I just followed kind of this approach of what can I do to make everyone's life easier and make this thing, you know, ship, basically. And, you know, year by year, years passed, and now I'm a product director.
Mm.
Yeah.
What are the, like, if you are product director, like, what are the type of decisions that you are making? You know, what are the type of things that you can influence?
Well, now, what we're doing now, or what I'm doing now, is like, I'm responsible for a whole, how would you call it, a pillar of a product, right? So basically, my current job is how do I make production super efficient, and how do I, you know, free up time for our users that are producing ads, if I'm very, you know, specific. But in general, like, if we make it more general, that would mean that the decisions you need to do or make, yeah, are on a much higher level. I don't design as much anymore. That's a bit of a, you know, it comes, I guess, with the job.
Yeah. Do you miss that?
Yeah, I do. I do miss it. But then again, you know, you are thinking far more strategically and far more horizontally. So how will my product or my solution plug into other solutions, right? How does the whole flow come together? Okay, are we reusing our modules enough? Are we building the same solutions on other products that we shouldn't, you know, that could be solved with the ones that we are building somewhere else, and, you know, stuff like that. So you're basically the architect of one of the solutions that we're building, and that comes with, you know, market knowledge, like everything, basically.
So I think what's coming through this conversation is that you have a pretty good overview of all three pillars. Kind of, you understand the design, you understand the tech, and you also understand the business.
Business is a very big piece of what you need to understand at this level, at least, because if you don't, you don't know how and who you're selling to.
Exactly. So how did you learn about that? Was it like on the job, or
I'm gonna say it again, the Marty's book, I guess it's Inspired, I think, is a really good book. I think every designer or product manager should read it. It's very, very to the point.
Sorry, what's the book?
The book is called Inspired by Marty Kagan. You know, SVG, Silicon Valley, what is it? Group. SVPG, sorry. Silicon Valley Product Group.
And what did you like about this book? What's so great about it?
Huh. That's a loaded question. it goes and it explains product managers far better than I could ever dream of. It goes through the process. It goes through the requirements. Even it goes through the mindset. And I think it translates great. It translates very nicely into product design. Or design, even, because I still think that designers are basically, they should be mini architects, right? They shouldn't be stylists. Stylists are, you know, I don't know, hairdressers. You know what I mean? Like, you shouldn't be making it pretty. You should be thinking about the system.
One other thing I wanted to ask you is that when you're at this level, how do you, in a sense, defend design? You know, like, a lot of designers have a feeling that business people just care about revenue, costs, mm-hmm. profit. And yeah, designers just mostly think about customers and how to make the more value for them and how to make their life easier. So mm-hmm. when you're in that boardroom, how do you try to balance these two perspectives?
So first, I would say that designers need to know their worth, right? If someone is focusing on numbers a bit too much, that is a problem. But it also comes from a different perspective. So it's kind of like them focusing on the user too much. So I would say that especially with enterprise software, you will usually have more than one user. And one of those two is a so-called captive user. And this means they don't have much or any say when the software gets bought, right? Or how it gets bought or which software gets bought. They may have. It depends greatly on the company they're at. But we call them the captive users. Like if your company gets Creative Cloud or if it gets, Corel, right? You don't have much say in that.
Yeah.
If they sign a contract. So with enterprise software, it's kind of this spiel, right? It's a bit shitty, but still, you as the designer and the product manager need to know that and acknowledge this. So what we do, how we balance this, because with our software, it's the same deal, right? A user that is not the end user buys the software. So the other thing is also, it's not cheap, right? Enterprise software is expensive, like super expensive. It's not $90 a month, right? It's $100,000 a month. So obviously, companies will want extra validation before they pull the trigger. So why am I saying this? I'm kind of unpacking this whole question of yours, right? Mm-hmm. So this means that depending on the company, you can see involvement from legal, you can see involvement from procurement, from finance, from IT, other executives, right, who will be looking for value in your product. It's not just your end user. So if you think about that, even as a designer, you're like, oh, shit, right? there's a lot more variables than just the end user and the usability. But on the other side of things, you also have the actual operator of the software. So designers usually have this one covered, right? Where the I have to confess, I was the same, right? I was the but the user guy, right? Mm-hmm. So because we like to advocate for the user, we're like, if you're a more empathetic kind of person, you're even worse because you're like, you know, you tend to take it to another level. So, but what we didn't realize is that, especially for B2B and more specifically enterprise software, that there are, you know, more than one user to advocate for. So if I pull it back, right, this is the usability piece, whereas the, you know, above or before, what I was speaking before, is the business piece that you need to understand, right?
It's a great point, right? You have multiple users or customers in that one single product.
Yes.
And the bigger the product, the more that happens. So does that mean that design team or research team at Tiltra does research with all of these stakeholders in a sense?
I mean, ideally, yes. Ideally, but you know, in the real world, sometimes that gets complicated. But we try to, yes, to involve the engineer and the designer with the product manager when they do all these decisions.
Got it. Cool. I also want to be mindful of your time, Matiz. So just as a last question, do you have any, we discussed it earlier, like, do you have any unpopular opinions in the design community? Anything that you view as being a popular opinion, but actually you might think it's wrong?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah. How do I kind of... I need to package this a bit more acceptably. I think currently in design there is a... almost like the design... has an identity crisis at this moment, right? So there's all these echo chambers, which are, you know, okay, we have inclusive design, we have designing with empathy, we have, I don't know, some people are discovering that if you're a designer, you need to be ethical. Wow, right? Or there's designers or people that are suddenly realizing that being a exclusively data-driven is not the best thing to do. So this to me is like, okay, so if we unpack this, you have the inclusive design fallacy, I guess, right? Because this thing is focusing on the symptoms. It's not focusing on the outcomes. So the outcome should be a design. Okay, this is, I guess I haven't packaged it neatly as everything else, but I would say that when you are designing something or when you're building something, you should be thinking of all of those things by default. This is nothing new, right? This is old school design right there. You know, design should be ecological, design should be ethical, design should be you know, as little design as possible. You know who I'm talking about. This is nothing new. Like, why are we rediscovering this with such pomp and labeling it as new? This is nothing new. This is expected from designers.
Yeah, I guess it's just the problem that, like you said, it's such a new field that everything that's discovered, everything new kind of excites people so much that they take it to the extreme. And then
that's damaging.
Exactly.
Becomes damaging, right?
Yeah. So it's basically the balance that...
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that the basic principles of design will always stand true. They're very, very, you know, very open, very modular, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to have different principles for product design because that's just bullshit. You know, I still think that context is everything in design. This is like the one rule you should be following is, you know, context is everything, even in product management. When you're setting up stuff, you need to think about the context.
Cool. Well, Matiz, thanks a lot for sharing also the unpopular opinion with us. just as a last question, where can listeners find or maybe reach out to you if they have any questions?
I guess Twitter. Twitter would be okay. I don't know my handle. Let me check my handle. real quick. I think it's just... I think it's super easy. Let me.
While you're looking for that, I'm also going to include the link to your Twitter handle on the website, beyondusers.com/podcast, so you can also find it there. Yeah. Did I buy you enough time? Did you find it now?
Yeah, it's basically Matiz Pilsl, so at Matiz Pilsl, so name, surname.
It might be a bit tough for...
Yes.
Yes, with the pronunciation. So you can find it online. It's there, and even in the show notes.
Wait, I know how to spell it because I've been here so long. So Matiz Pilsl.
Perfect. Cool. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time, sharing all this stuff with us.
Thank you for having me, really.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
I've been honored. I am honored.
Cool. So that's all in this episode. If you have any feedback for me or for Matiz, just find us on probably the best place for Matiz is on Twitter, and for me is on LinkedIn. So if you have any feedback, any thoughts, just reach out. And again, if you do want to learn more about business, you can visit the beyondusers.com and take a 5-day email course. And in these emails, you can basically learn about 5 business concepts that are relevant for designers. Thanks for your attention and see you next time.